Case of the morning is Jackson v. Las Lunas Community Program, number 16-2172. Counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Jerry Wallace, and this is James Grubel. We represent the appellants, the State of New Mexico defendants in this particular case. Following a quarter century plus of litigation, coupled with the application of, we believe, on-point United States Supreme Court precedent, particularly Horn v. Flores and Rufo v. Suffolk County inmates, it is now time for this honorable court to end the federal court's jurisdiction of the Jackson litigation. During this past 25 years, and it is important to know this historically why we are here, there has been many things that have happened that has led us to your doorstep and here in court today. Briefly, to put this in historical context, this lawsuit was filed in 1987. After multiple years of litigation in 1990, the court issued a very important order. In that order, the court found violations of the Section 504 and also 14th Amendment substantive due process violations of the class members that were at the Los Lunas Hospital and Training School and Fort Stanton. The court specifically found 18 areas of deficiency. So that was the first major order that was entered by the court in this case. Subsequently, the court granted a motion to amend by interlineation to allow plaintiffs to add an ADA claim. Then as the case proceeds along, we know that on June 27, 1994, the court entered an order regarding Fort Stanton. And this was a very important order because it helps define what the court was looking at so we can also look and see what the intent of all these court orders were that came subsequently. And this was in relation to Fort Stanton. And the court specifically said, in the event that all class members have been transferred from Fort Stanton to appropriate settings by July 31, 1995, this order and all portions of the court's original order, dated December 28, 1990, concerning corrections of deficiencies, including deficiency areas 8, 9, and 10 at Fort Stanton, will hereby be terminated. Well, Fort Stanton, in fact, did close in March of 1995, and Los Lunas in July 1997. So where are the class members, you ask? Well, they've all been being placed into community settings as the court had instructed. As we go along, though, the court in its diligence, and Judge Parker is an exceptional judge. I had cases with him when he's on the, as a lawyer, and I've appeared from maybe 100 times on the bench. But he wanted to be sure that these individuals were taken care of even after leaving the institutions. So the parties, on December 19, 1997, the next key document was a joint stipulation on disengagement, known as the JSD. And then subsequent to that, there were additional obligations that were added pursuant to a plan of action and Appendix A. And that is kind of the historical framework initially. Now we move along in time. And during the year, the interceding years, the state has been trying to comply with these various obligations and, in fact, make some strides, even as recognized several times by Judge Parker in various decisions that we cite in our briefs. But unfortunately, and despite the best efforts, the state still was unable to comply. Now, another major turning point in the case so we can understand this contextually was on July 15, 2010, the plaintiffs filed a motion for further remedial relief, claimed that the defendants, the state defendants, were not adhering to the agreements and that we were violating Section 504 and the ADA. So those are the constitutional claims that are still out there. So then what happened next in this sequence is the court, on its own, on January 27, 2011, denied that motion, and the court scheduled an evidentiary trial for June 13 through 17, 2011. Before that occurred, and at the pretrial conference, we had filed a 60B5 motion on April 27, 2011. And the court basically said, look, I'm going to do this huge evidentiary trial. Bring me all the evidence. I'm going to hear everything there is to hear, and then I'll make a ruling and determination of what is going on. And that's exactly what the court did. So we had this huge evidentiary trial June 13 through 17, live witnesses, the special master testified, community monitor testified, various experts on both sides testified. And it took the court a while, and I'm not being critical here because it was complex. The court entered an order on October 12, 2012, in a 206-page opinion, issuing findings and conclusions from that evidentiary hearing. Now, of major significance is the fact that the court said specifically, the court is unable to find any violations of ADA or Section 504. Further, despite...
Actually, didn't the court say it's unable to conclude that defendants have violated the Rehabilitation Act and the ADA, meaning it didn't say it did and it didn't say you didn't. So well, I can't conclude one way or the
sure,
other.
Sure, sure. We put the exact quote in there. We're not trying to hide the exact quote. But the court did not conclude, and we'll go with that. I believe that that's the exact quote, that the court's unable to conclude to find any kind of violation or a violation of the ADA or Section 504. And in our 60B5 motion, Judge McHugh, that the court had held in advance, we had asked specifically to rule on any ongoing constitutional violations or any other issues. The court held that in abeyance on its own accord, just said it's in, held it in abeyance. Then afterwards, the court invited and plaintiffs, in fact, filed another motion to compel now that they had all the evidence and the court's ruling in front of it. Despite that, and the court essentially having another bite at the apple, still was unable to conclude a violation of either Section 504 or the ADA, and there was no finding you'll see anywhere in his judgment, in his order, that will say that there was any ongoing substantive due process violations similar to what he found in 1990 or any constitutional violations. Not there, period. Not there in that massive judgment back in 2016. Now, the plaintiffs are very good lawyers. They're experts in this field. I think they recognize the weakness in those findings. So they... The plaintiffs, the appellees here, filed a motion asking the court to strike that finding that the court was unable to conclude that there were any violations of the ADA in Section 504. Now, in an ironic twist of procedure, the court instead invited the plaintiffs, why don't you go ahead and file a disparate treatment claim under the McDonnell-Douglas aircraft test? And why don't you just handle it that way? If there's anything to handle, but they did not do it. Instead, they persisted on with trying to get the court to change its opinion. The court invited them a second time to file a McDonnell-Douglas disparate treatment claim, which they did not do. So it finally was finalized. The court decision stood. It wasn't altered or changed. So this now is in 2016. Now, why didn't we appeal then? I know that that question might be on your minds, and I'm going to answer it right now. We didn't appeal then because it wasn't ripe. It wasn't ripe for several reasons. One, it was the fact that there were still some substantial compliance issues out there. Second, there were not unforeseen or changed circumstances that came later as a result of the issuance of that order pursuant to RUFO and Horn that were not yet in existence to make this ripe for appeal. So then what happened, I'm sorry, Judge, you have...
Yeah, I'm just worried you're going to run out of time.
I'm moving along fast. I'll answer any question anybody might have.
Yeah, because I think we're all knowledgeable.
Sure,
about
sure,
that.
Okay.
And it seems to me that the first question I have is what are the... You're relying only on factual changes in circumstances, right? Factual changes.
No.
What are you specifically relying on? And were they things that you should have been aware of at the time you entered into these consent decrees?
Okay. We're relying on both factual and legal changes. The legal changes are the close of the institutions, the determination by the court that it was unable to conclude any violation of 504 and the ADA. Those are legal.
Okay. Your brief was just factual.
Okay. On the factual changes, we can after the 2016 order was entered, the JCA was appointed. She imposed a remedial plan that added multiple other obligations. We have the exact numbers in our brief, as does Judge Parker. He mentions them. Judge Parker also had to enter a remedial plan that he had to craft on his own accord There was evaluative components that were added to the point that there, according to even Judge Parker, there's 307 discrete components, and he goes through the process.
Okay, so let me stop you for a minute.
Sure.
So the factual changes are an increase in the detail and number of requirements for compliance.
Absolutely.
Okay. What other factual changes?
Well, those are major, and they were also unforeseen. And also, you had the judge did not utilize Judge McHugh the flexible approach as required by both Rufo and Horn to ensure that the authority go back to the newly elected officials of the state. The judge did not do that, and he should have done that because, as I've said, and that's why it's so important to go to this history. I'm sorry, but there was no longer any violation that the court found or concluded for 504 or the ADA. All we have left are contractual obligations that do not flow from the court's original order. And all those are very important. It's a multi-pronged analysis that you have to use under both Rufo and Horn. And I'd like to reserve my 359.
Well, we've only asked you a couple of questions.
Sure.
And I think we have a few. Let me ask you one thing about Horn.
Sure.
If you can give me some help on how you see Horn relating to Rufo. In Horn, Justice Alito at one point says a critical question in this Rule 60b-5 inquiry is whether the objective of the district court's declaratory judgment issue has been achieved. So
right.
He refers to objective.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes on to write, if a durable remedy has been implemented, mm-hmm. continued enforcement of the order is not only unnecessary but improper. So first of all, I'm interested in whether you regard Horn as establishing a test that is separate and apart from the test that was stated in Rufo.
I do. I think that you can draw from both cases, but I think Horn stands on its own accord. And also I want to say that using the critical inquiry, we met the objectives of the original order in 1990 in stopping the constitutional violations under the substantive due process 14th Amendment.
My next question
sure.
goes to that. So let me.
I'm sorry.
Just, no,
sure.
It's fine. But if you're trying, you're asking, your motion asked for termination of everything.
That's right.
All the orders and the case.
Yes.
So under this Horn test, did you need to show that the objectives of each of the still existing remedial orders have been met?
No, we don't have to do that under Horn. And Horn is very specific and basically says the court needs to be mindful that if there are no ongoing constitutional violations, that is to be determined to be a factor in the court's determination as to whether to end the jurisdiction and vest it back to the state.
How is no violation the same thing as not fulfilling the objectives? You might not have a violation, but you still may have objectives to fulfill.
Well, sure, there's contractual objectives.
Well, that's what I mean.
Sure.
It doesn't Horn require you to show that?
No, I don't believe it does. In fact, I think Horn even takes that in consideration whenever it says that specifically institutional reform injunctions bind states and local officials to the policy preferences of their predecessors and may thereby improperly deprive future officials of their designated legislative and executive powers. These contractual obligations, we have never come and said we've met all the contractual
all right.
obligations.
Let me jump to one other.
Sure,
I know
please,
we're
Judge Matheson.
Why wouldn't the failure to fulfill the multiple obligations that are still listed at some length out there be probative of whether there's a durable remedy in place? If you've got a lot of unfulfilled obligations, how does that show there's a durable remedy in place?
Sure. Well, the contractual obligation still must be tied into a violation of some sort versus just contractual obligations. When you say, let's provide for health and safety and supported employment.
But a durable remedy was sure. a separate prong of the Horn test.
That's right. And a durable.
You take away the violations, you fulfilled all the objectives, but the situation has to be durable.
That's right.
And yet, we've got these consent decrees
right.
that you and opposing counsel and the court have hammered out, and you've got the compliance administrator adding to them. And
right.
then at the end of the day, there's a lot of them that still haven't happened, and that doesn't sound durable.
Well, the durable remedy is the fact that the constitutional violations that were visited upon these individuals when they were at Los Lunas Hospital and Training School in Fort Stanton and the violations of the ADA and the Section 504 will not happen again. That's the durable remedy, and that's been met. They're all in community-based settings. They're all in the DD waiver program, that which is considered the gold standard of developmental disability benefits. There is a durable remedy in place. That was all put in our 60B5 motion, which was verified what the durable remedy was. And that was not, we don't believe that there's evidence to the contrary, so we don't have a durable remedy.
Well, the district court went through in quite a lot of detail,
yes,
showing areas in which the violations were actually having an impact on people in the community setting, the class members who are in the community setting. So I know there wasn't a finding about whether there is or isn't a violation of the ADA or there is and isn't a violation of the Constitution, but there's certainly been findings that these agreements that set up the things you were supposed to do to see that you had a durable remedy have not been met, and that there's negative implications from that.
Well, again, based on the sheer number of the contractual obligations, many of them aspirational in nature, they're never going to be met. I'm candidly telling you that. If we don't look at this pursuant to Horn and look at the detrimental impact, and Judge Parker even does a good job saying why we can't meet all these obligations. We quote him time and time and time again. He doesn't even know the extent of the obligations. There's 307, there's overlapping obligations, et cetera, et cetera. You'll basically force the state and let the federal court appropriate the state's budget, take away this important field from the state. There's been over $50 million spent on this litigation. Judge Parker said, who does this litigation cost benefit? Not the Jackson class members.
Well, but we're reviewing his 65
sure
decision, and we're reviewing it for abuse of discretion.
That's right.
So let me ask a related question. You didn't ask under Rule 60B5 to have the consent decrees modified, narrowed, slimmed down. You're asking to just get rid of everything.
How can that
wholesale termination be a tailored remedy?
Well, it's tailored because, again, and I always harken back to this, there has to be some type of ongoing, we believe, constitutional or federal statutory violation, which if you can find some in one of Judge Parker's order where he says there is a violation going on of the ADA, there is a violation going on of 504, or there's a substantive due process violation, I think you're absolutely right. But he didn't. So we're just talking, Judge Matheson, about mere contractual obligations only that has divested the state of New Mexico and the state defendants of its lawful authority and its state sovereign immunity to the detriment, and even Judge Parker uses that language, to the detriment of the public interest.
So is the remedy to remand for the district court to make a finding specifically of whether there's continuing violations of the ADA or the Constitution?
Well, I thought that's, Your Honor, in all due respect, I thought that's what we did in our evidentiary trial in June of 2011, because the court asked specifically, it's in our brief, for the plaintiffs to identify what specific areas do you believe are not in compliance. And we all know what the judge ruled.
Well, that's your argument, but you also said that Judge Parker hadn't made that decision either.
I'm sorry?
Didn't you say that Judge Parker hadn't reached a determination on continuing violations?
What the judge said, and Judge McHugh read the language exactly, is Judge Parker said he could not conclude that there was a violation.
No, I'm not talking about 2012. I'm talking about the order that we're reviewing right now.
Yes. And I'm sorry, your question again, Judge Matheson.
Where does he say there are no – where does he actually decide whether there are ongoing violations in that order?
He doesn't.
That's my point.
He doesn't. But he does repeat language from his 2012 order saying that he was unable to conclude that there were violations of the ADA and Section 504. He does reincorporate that.
Right, in response to an argument from you that he actually decided it, he was clarifying, no, I didn't decide it, this is what I said.
Well, that's what he says in 2016. That's certainly not what the language looked like in 2012. And another thing, too, that that we think has precluded this litigation is after he issued that order in 2016, he targeted a date of July 11, 2014, to conclude the litigation. He thinks that all the requirements could be met. And we put in a tremendous amount of effort, couldn't do it, and this goes into the Horn analysis, Judge Matheson and Judge McKay as well, is that there was these unforeseen and significant changes that occurred that are spoke about in both Horn and Rufo, where they started piling on more and more and more obligations, evaluative components that were unforeseen and that cannot be met, and that we cannot, in any of Judge Parker's orders, link specifically to any 14th Amendment substantive due process violation or any violation of Section 504 of the ADA. Thank you for giving me a few extra moments.
Well, the overview was helpful, and we needed to ask you a few extra questions.
Well, thank you.
Fine, and
we'll
give your colleague some extra time, too, if he needs it.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Stephen Schwartz. I represent Walter Stephen Jackson and a class of individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Before I turn to the merits, I want to take just a moment to pause on the issue of jurisdiction. The state has asserted and then reasserted that this court has jurisdiction under 28 U.S.C. 1291, claiming that it's a final order of the district court. But the order denying termination of this case was not a final order. The district court made that very clear in its opinion as it invited the defendants to file future motions for relief from specific provisions of its remedial injunction. In fact, that has happened. Since the filing of this appeal, Judge Parker has entered several additional orders, all at the request of the defendants, all based on, assented to motions to disengage or terminate specific provisions of his remedial injunction.
Is the additional litigation on the merits, or is it part of the supervision of the decree?
Well, it's the injunctive order that Judge Parker entered in 2014 and 15 is now what is controlling the litigation. It is the merits. It is what is required of the defendants. It is what Judge Parker is overseeing, and what remains to terminate. Under Judge, now Justice, Gorsuch's opinion in McClendon versus City of Albuquerque, the district court's decision denying the Rule 60B motion did not terminate anything, and it allowed the litigation to continue. As Judge Gorsuch had found in McClendon, this didn't end the litigation, and it did not dissociate the court in any way from the litigation. And this court has followed that opinion in Hayes versus Family Trust, and so therefore, under McClendon, we believe this appeal should be dismissed just as Justice Gorsuch dismissed the appeal in that case. Let me turn now to the merits. This appeal can, I think, be reduced to a single contention, and this court has already, in your questions, noted that. Did Judge Parker commit plain error, that is definite, clear, and unmistakable error, when he found that neither the objects of his prior orders had been achieved, nor the conditions that flowed from the constitutional and statutory deficiencies that he identified in 1990 had been permanently cured? The answer, we suggest, is plainly no.
Does it matter that the Judge Parker did not make a finding that there are ongoing constitutional violations of federal statute?
Not only does it not matter, the Supreme Court in Frew versus Hawkins rejected precisely that approach. It said that when there are settlement agreements, as there are here, And those settlement agreements are designed to cure federal violations, as they do here, because both the 1997 settlement agreement and the 2005 settlement agreement, he found, and the parties stipulated, were explicitly designed to correct the constitutional and statutory violations that he found existed in 1990. And so, in Frew, the issue before the Supreme Court, Texas made an argument that when time comes to review or enforce or perhaps disengage from a ongoing consent decree, that was a case involving the Medicaid statute, that the plaintiffs need to show, in order for the court to continue its jurisdiction, that there are ongoing federal violations. The court unanimously rejected that position. It found that the very purpose of having a settlement agreement was to do more than, as Justice Kennedy found, do more than simply hit a constitutional floor. And so as long as the court can determine that the agreements are necessary to cure federal violations or conditions that flow from those violations, those agreements are binding, and the states that enter them must comply with them.
Can I just ask on that point whether that relates to the language in Horn about satisfying the objectives of the remedial order?
I think it does. That is, I think there was in Frew a recognition that by the Supreme Court that there were important federal interests that states have, and that when federal courts find that the agreements have been satisfied, or, as clarified by Horn, that the objectives of the agreements have been satisfied.
Right. But let me just ask you a question about what needs to be done on a 60B5 motion as far as Horn objectives are concerned, because it seems to me that Judge Parker's order focused more on the fact that there were obligations under these orders that had not been met. But it raised this question. Are obligations the same thing as objectives, or are those two different things?
I think they are two different things. I think that the court found, for instance, that in the 1997 settlement agreement and in the 2005 settlement agreement, that there were a significant number of provisions, specific obligations that the defendants had agreed to undertake. And the reason they had agreed to undertake them was because they understood that the plaintiff's motion sought relief from constitutional and statutory conditions. And so they settled this in order to settle and avoid litigation on constitutional and statutory grounds.
Well, let me just tell you where I'm going with
sure.
this. Because did Judge Parker focus on the right question then in terms of the Horn test by considering unfulfilled obligations instead of focusing more on whether the overall purpose or objective of the consent decrees have been met?
Well, in his 2012 order, which was challenging a number of very specific obligations, he found there were approximately 99 violations of various provisions of health, safety, and employment. When he was asked in the Rule 60B motion to terminate everything, as the courts noted, he wasn't asked to terminate the ones that were confusing, or the ones that were ambiguous, or the ones that the defendants said they had completed, or the ones that were outdated, or the ones that were obsolete. He was asked to vacate everything, everything he had done for 20 years, and everything the parties had to agree to over the last two decades. He looked at the objectives. He looked at and said there were three general objectives. Protect people's safety. Ensure minimally adequate health care. And provide them access to employment opportunities. He noted that those objectives, which are more general, had not been met. And his finding that, A, that is what the objectives of his court orders were.
By the way, are you now referring to the 2012 order or the 2016 order?
No, I'm referring to his 2016 order.
Well, that's what I was looking for, something that said exactly what you said. But we can both read it later.
He said he found on Joint Appendix page 7432.
What's the page of the opinion?
Oh, sorry. Page of the opinion was page 31.
Thank you.
And I quote on the top paragraph, because all of these outstanding obligations grew out of the court's 1990 order and its related 2012 findings, the defendants have not convinced the court that they've satisfied the essential purposes of these. And he found in the prior, and he found that the essential purposes of the earlier orders were to protect the health, safety, and employment opportunities of individuals. I think what Judge Parker did in that situation is to recognize the flexibility that Horn requires him to do. He noted that in addition to the fact that the defendants had not provided a suitably tailored motion, had not done, as this court asked my brother, whether or not specific provisions could be eliminated, he also noted they had not produced any evidence whatsoever that the violations had been cured. They didn't produce any evidence that the essential purposes concerning health, safety, and employment had been addressed. In answer to Judge McHugh's question about the factual circumstances, the motion that was brought before the judge, the 65B motion, alleged really only one factual circumstance. That changed factual circumstances. That factual circumstance was that the new orders that had been entered to remedy the ongoing health and safety violations were burdensome, onerous, and unworkable. On appeal, the defendants added another factual circumstance, that is the closure of the institutions in 1997. But that circumstance about the closure of the institutions, which was not presented to the district court, although it certainly knew about it, was not timely. It was 20 years before that the institutions had closed. And so the defendants can't wait under Rule 60C, 2 decades before claiming that a factual circumstance is sufficient to warrant the modification, nor are the reasons that they gave in their motion, that is, the new orders. It can't be that when a district court makes findings of violations of its own orders, settlement agreements, and enters a remedial injunction, that the remedial injunction is itself a changed circumstance. That can't be. That's circular. And so the motion that...
you're saying that new orders don't count as changed circumstances.
Not when those new orders are based on an evidentiary trial and findings of violations of prior orders.
Well, I understand the logic of the argument. Are there any cases that say that, however?
We have several cases in our briefs that, and I'll provide them to the court in a supplemental filing if the court would like, that say that Rufo specifically speaks of unanticipated conditions as being the basis for unforeseen or unanticipated conditions.
Well, it also speaks of foreseen changes that are onerous. It speaks of both unforeseen and foreseen changes of circumstances.
But the changes need to post-date the remedial order. If a district court orders the defendants to take certain actions, if it turns out that those actions are unworkable, are onerous, changed circumstance make it no longer appropriate, just as in Horn, the original Horn order by the district court in Arizona around English-speaking students was approximately in 2000. A number of events, the Supreme Court, Justice Alito points to, changes about a statute, changes in practical ways of teaching students, changes in funding. Those, Justice Alito says, could constitute, did constitute, changed circumstances, but they all happened after the original district court's funding order. Here we have the district court. If the defendants had claimed there were changed circumstances after the 1990 order, after the 1997 order, that would be something different. That's not what they claimed. Remember that both of the institutions had closed at the time that they agreed to the 1997 order.
Speaking of that, do you agree with counsel that because they have been closed, there's no ongoing substantive due process violation?
No, we don't, Your Honor. You're asking whether because the facility is closed. No. Well, we answer this way. First and foremost, what Horn speaks to is not simply whether there's an ongoing federal violation, but whether the conditions which flow from those violations.
Yeah, let's limit it to the violation. Is there any ongoing violation of the substantive due process clause in light of the fact that the institutions are closed?
Well, actually, in New Mexico, the New Mexico Court of Appeals has found that when an individual is transferred by the state from a state facility to a community program that the state operates and funds, that implicates constitutional rights. That's a case called Balboa versus, I'll get it for you, but I'll give you this. So we do believe that there can be constitutional violations even when the facilities close under New Mexico law. That case is La Balboa versus Himes, 850 Pacific 2nd, 1017, New Mexico Court of Appeals in 1993. So yes, Your Honor, there can be under New Mexico law. Normally we would say there are not under federal constitutional law. But there are, and this is what the order that my brother spoke to around Fort Stan. When the Fort Stan facility was about to close, remember the defendants have confined individuals to their institutions. Then they decide, which is entirely their right and prerogative, to close those facilities. They then transfer. They transfer all the individuals to institute other facilities that they create, fund, and operate.
Well, I understand your point, but I only ask if there's a violation of federal constitutional law, not state constitutional law, federal substantive due process law. And I take it that your answer is your answer isn't no.
No, there are not independent constitutional violations that would occur for individuals who live in the community, but when constitutional conditions have been found by the court to have been violated, then they have to flow from that. Yes, they do.
What is the proper place in our analysis to look at the federalism concerns? We have a case that has been going on for 25 years. We have a federal Article III district judge basically micromanaging social services for the state of New Mexico to the tune of millions of dollars per year. I mean, at some point this needs to come to an end, doesn't it?
We agree, Your Honor. And Judge Parker noted in his opinion, as I'm sure you said, that he would jump at a legitimate opportunity to conclude his oversight of this case. That's a quote from him. And what he invited the defendants to do, although they have not done, is to submit to him narrowly tailored motions to disengage or end any provision that they believe is obsolete, unworkable, no longer relevant. He gave a long list of the types of provisions and rationale for those provisions for him to end. He also said that if the objectives of the decree, the larger objectives of protecting people's health, protecting people's safety, ensuring minimally adequate health care and access to employment opportunities. If those larger objectives are met through other means, the quote from Justice Alito's opinion in Horn. So he was not saying that every single provision of the orders have to be met to a T, but rather the objectives of the order have to be satisfied. And he found they weren't, and his opinions, his views, his findings on what those objectives were of his orders and the party's agreement, and whether or not they had been met, are entitled to deference, particularly where we have a judge who has been involved in a case from its inception, where he understands the purposes as well as the implications of his orders and the parties' agreements. I would say also, Your Honor, that we, the plaintiffs, have as our goal the prompt ending of this case. We are involved, myself and the public interest firm that where I work, have been involved in multiple cases, some which have gone on longer than this case, and we have brought them to responsible conclusions. We have done that by partnering with the states and having the states fulfill their obligations under the orders, with the plaintiffs being flexible and willing to look at the larger purposes, not only every specific word. And as a result of those efforts, we have ended cases in multiple states, and we have ended them successfully in a way that doesn't have a wholesale vacatur of an entire case because the defendants have decided that they are no longer willing or able to make any efforts whatsoever to comply with this. So we believe the next step in terms of the federalism concerns is just what Judge Parker invited the defendants to do. Come back and, as he said multiple times in his 2016 opinion, there are provisions which seem aspirational or which are confusing. Let's find a way to get rid of them. The plaintiffs have, as you note, in 2015, agreed to disengage every provision that was implicated by or otherwise superseded by the recent 2015 injunctive order. We remain so willing. In fact, we are enthusiastic to do so. We want this case to end, but for people with intellectual disabilities in New Mexico, it must end in a way that protects their federal rights and protects the agreements that have been entered to ensure their health, safety, and employment access.
Counsel,
thank you very much.
I think we've about reached equal time. That's good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you both for your arguments. So we appreciate your help on this long-running case. And it will be now submitted, and counsel are excused.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.